Monday the 9th of October 1769. Gentle breezes and clear weather. PM stood into the bay and anchored on the northeast side before the entrance of a small river. In 10 fathom water, a fine sandy bottom. The northeast point of the bay bore east by south 1-2 S, and the southwest point south, distant from the shore half a league. After this, I went ashore with a party of men in the pinnace and the yawl, accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Sullender. We landed abreast of the ship and on the east side of the river just mentioned, but seeing some of the natives on the other side of the river, whom I was desirous of speaking with, and finding that we could not ford the river, I ordered the yawl in to carry us over and the pinnace to lay at the entrance. In the meantime, the Indians made off. However, we went as far as their huts, which lay about 200 or 300 yards from the waterside, leaving four boys to take care of the yawl, which we had no sooner left than four men came out of the woods on the other side of the river and would certainly have cut her off had not the people in the pinnace discovered them and called to her to drop down the stream, which they did, being closely pursued by the Indians. The coxswain of the pinnace, who had charge of the boats, seeing this, fired two muskets over their heads. The first made them stop and look round them, but the second they took no notice of, upon which a third was fired and killed one of them upon the spot, just as he was going to dart his spear at the boats. At this, the other three stood motionless for a minute or two, seemingly quite surprised, wondering no doubt what it was that had thus killed their comrade. But as soon as they recovered themselves, they made off, dragging the dead body a little way, and then left it. Upon our hearing the reports of the muskets, we immediately repaired to the boats, and after viewing the dead body, we returned on board. In the morning, seeing a good number of the natives at the same place where we saw them last night, I went ashore with the boats, manned and armed, and landed on the opposite side of the river. Mr. Banks, Dr. Solander, and myself at first only landed and went to the side of the river, the natives being got together on the opposite side. We called to them in the George Island language, but they answered us by flourishing their weapons over their head and dancing, as we supposed, the war dance. Upon this we retired until the marines were landed, which I ordered to be drawn up about 200 yards behind us. We then went again to the riverside, having Tupaya, Mr. Green, and Dr. Monkhouse along with us. Tupaya spoke to them in his own language, and it was an agreeable surprise to find they perfectly understood him. After some little conversation had passed, one of them swam over to us, and after him 20 or 30 more. These last brought their arms with them, which the first man did not. We made at them everyone presents. But this did not satisfy them. They wanted but everything we had about us, particularly our arms, and made several attempts to snatch them out of our hands. Tupaya told us several times as soon as they came over to take care of ourselves, for they were not our friends, and this we very soon found, for one of them snatched Mr. Green's hanger from him and would not give it up. This encouraged the rest to be more insolent, and seeing others coming over to join them, I ordered the man who had taken the hanger to be fired at, which was accordingly done, and wounded in such a manner that he died soon after. Okay, so this is the very first contact between the British crew and the Maori. Excuse me. Okay, so I'm going to have a look at how we would do a commentaire de text here. In your exam, I will give you one which is a bit easier than this. Good. I know that you have in other classes learned about commentaire de text, but also they're pretty difficult, and you've never really finished learning how to do it. I'm hoping to revise some of the methodology and also learn something. I'm going to use a lot of things I know about Cook which you don't know. So of course, when you get the exam, you're supposed to know use the things you do know and not the things you don't know. That's a bit obvious, wasn't it? Okay, so the most important thing I would say about your civilisation commentaire is it is not a literary text commentary. Et c'est assez souvent que les étudiants commencent à le regarder comme si c'était de la littérature, et donc on va avoir, oui, les champs lexicaux, et patati patata, which is rarely so important. What you're supposed to be doing is to show you know things. You're supposed to show, one, that your English is so good that you understand almost everything. If you see something which is difficult to understand, but you understand it, you must make sure you show you understand it. Of course, if you don't understand it, you don't understand it. Don't try to fool the examiner. They are smarter than you. Yeah. If you don't understand it, we will know. Yeah. You can't. Avoiding things, you know, it doesn't work. Yeah. It's better to say, paragraph 4 is difficult to understand for me, rather than say nothing about paragraph 4 and hope we won't notice. We will notice. That's our job. I'm not trying to frighten you, incidentally. So the first thing you're showing is that, you understand the English. Secondly, you're showing you write in reasonably correct English. Thirdly, you're showing that you understand what the document does. Who is he talking to? What can we understand from here, which is not written? What can we understand about Cook's attitude, about the facts of the voyage, about the future of this contact, which brings us right up to today with, you know, the two names for New Zealand, just directly from here, the commemoration of this particular... No, you don't know this, but I haven't explained yet. This particular day is commemorated and celebrated or not celebrated, depending on the attitudes of different people. You will notice that some of the words, you don't know the words. However, some of them you can guess. I'm not going to ask you to do this, but the pinnace and the yawl, it's not difficult to guess that they are boats. Now, they left the ship and they went in a pinnace and a yawl to the shore. They're boats, yeah. The pinnace and the yawl are boats. The other thing which is difficult is if you look at the bottom, four lines from the end, one of the locals steals Mr. Green's hanger. Alors, ça peut vouloir dire un cintre, mais ça semble pas probable qu'il se balade avec un cintre. What do you imagine this means? Cook and his officers are panicked. It's very, very serious because somebody has stolen his hanger. Would you like to guess? No? What do you imagine they are carrying, which they would be most worried about? Which resembles a little bit of a hanger. It's not so difficult. I insist that somebody guesses. Notice what happened here. The local person stole the hanger and so they killed him. What? It must be an arm. It's a sword. They all walked around with swords and guns. And so the hanger is his sword. And you can see, so we're hoping that we can understand here then some of the attitudes of Cook and his things. Now, the general mistakes that people make in text commentaries, first of all, is obviously just to misunderstand the document. Secondly, this is the big one. Instead of a commentary, some people write a paraphrase, the same meaning in different words. And this this is what you really must not do. You get no points for paraphrasing. Yeah, the same meaning. Now, that's not quite true. You get a little bit because if you use different words, it shows you understand. But yeah. Paraphrasing is just a basic. You've got to analyse it. And the final mistake is to forget the passage and say, Cook's first expedition began in 17... And just repeats, réciter le cours. Okay? So what you're supposed to do is take something, make a link with something you learnt in class, make a conclusion. D'ailleurs, vous aurez plus de points pour des interprétations fausses que pour un manque absolu d'interprétation. Ça montre quand même que vous avez essayé de comprendre. Okay, so let's have a look at it little by little. Oh, finally, of course, we're supposed to be rather relatively analytical and objective. As you can see here, there are two. We see two Maoris killed. In the second case, Cook orders his officer to kill him. Now, it's quite clear that this is what a colonial attitude is at the time. Nevertheless, you know, our job is not to denounce Cook as a murderer. That is useful, but it's not our job. We're analysing. Okay, so you know whether Cook is a hero or a villain is not your problem. You're looking at it scientifically. At another moment, that could be your problem, but that's not your problem. Now, when we start a text commentary for Civilization, we have a series of questions that we try to look at. And not every question is useful every time, but you should always look at them. Who is speaking? Who are they speaking to? When are they speaking? Speaking or writing? What are they saying? Why are they saying it? What happens after, which is linked to it? How typical is the document? And what difference did it make? I'm going to repeat all those because those are the most important things. Now, you don't always have something to say about every question, but very often people forget them. Number one, who? Who is writing? I will go back to each one. Who are they writing to? This is very, very important, and very often this is forgotten by the students. Who are they writing to? This is not an easy question. Very often students write, not about this one, but about other documents. This is a document, it's written for everybody. Now, the document written for everybody doesn't exist. There is no document at all in the entire world which is written for everybody. Because the person writing it always has a priority. These are the people I want to convince. Just to take an example, take an election manifesto in Britain today. And one of my students told me yesterday, the manifesto is written for everybody. Absolutely not. Let's take the Conservative Party manifesto. They are not writing for my mother. My mother votes Conservative. She always voted Conservative. She always will vote Conservative. The people writing the manifesto are not worried about her. They don't have to persuade her. It's good. She's not important. At the same time, there are other people who never vote Conservative, detest the Conservatives. And the same thing, the manifesto is not... They're realistic people. They're not talking to these people. Party political manifestos are generally addressed to people who have not completely decided. Yeah. That's just an example. But every document, you need to spend a little time. Who are they trying to talk to? What is the essential content of the document? Also, what do they not say, which we might expect them to say? Now, this is speculative, but for example, in here... We notice that there is no religious content at all. There is no mention of God or praying or anything like that. And, you know, that might be unsurprising, but this is the 18th century. I say this because in his entire journal, there is almost nothing about God. And this is surprising at the time. That's just an example, but... things which are absent in this is for text commentaries in general. What is not there can be quite important. Why are they saying it? What is their objective? Again, this is something which is difficult, but it's better to speculate. If you say, they may well be writing this because that's very good. And you know, it might be right, you might be correct, you might not be correct, but that shows you have the right attitude. How do they try to reach their objective? I don't think this is so important here, but that there's questions like style, irony, arguments, and so on, especially the political speech. Yeah, are they mocking? Are they being sarcastic? Are they being emotional? He's particularly not being emotional. And indeed, the story of this conflict where some people are killed, and it's the first contact ever with a new people and possibly a new continent. Almost everybody on Cook's ship, they arrived in New Zealand and said, look, it's the southern continent. It's obvious. We knew there was a southern continent. Here it is. And in Cook will say, just a minute. Let's follow the coast. And he spends 6 months going all the way around New Zealand and drawing an amazing map. Then, of course, it wasn't the southern continent. And most of the crew were extremely disappointed because, find the southern continent, go home, be extremely rich. What's not to like? What happened afterwards? Extremely important and often forgotten. Does the document predict something or promise something or warn against something? Do some of the things which happen have a consequence in the future? They certainly do, because I mean, I'm giving you information that you don't have, but if I just go back here a little bit. From the Guardian newspaper 2 years ago. The British government has expressed regrets for the killing of Maori people in New Zealand after the explorer Captain James Cook's arrival in the country in 1769. The statement came from the British High Commissioner in New Zealand, Laura Clark, when she was speaking to local tribes. So this is 2 years ago. The British High Commissioner, Britain does not have an ambassador in New Zealand because it's part of the Commonwealth. They have a High Commissioner. And so for the first time 2 years ago, they apologised. So we can see what the other guy said. Yeah, the past isn't dead. It's not even really past. So we can see it's still very important because they apologise. In fact, that's not quite true, actually. The British government has expressed regrets. But, next paragraph, the statement from the British High Commissioner was made in private and stopped short of an apology. They did not say we apologise. They said we regret. Diplomatically, this is different. Now, you don't know why, but one of the reasons is that if you say we apologise, you could always say, it was our fault. What about compensation? This is a real question in international law. Whereas we regret is not quite an apology. The Guardian article continues, the meetings with iwi, that is tribes, in the city of Gisborne came days before a government-funded commemoration of Cook's landing there, including a replica of his sailing ship along with a flotilla of other vessels. The anniversary events have been attacked by some Maori groups as insensitive, and protests are expected at this weekend's events. So this is what the British High Commissioner says. What we did today really acknowledged, perhaps properly for the first time, that nine people and nine ancestors were killed in those first meetings between Captain Cook and New Zealand Maori. And that is not how any of us would have wanted those first encounters to have happened. So it's a really significant part of our shared history and a sad one. So it felt really important to acknowledge that pain of those first encounters. Acknowledge that the pain doesn't diminish over time. And if you do that, if you look back to address the wrongs of the past, it equips you better, I think, to look to the future and build a partnership. So you can see, you can feel the tension. We're sorry, kind of. I mean, everybody hates saying sorry. That's what, just one example. So what happened after is an extremely important part of every text commentary. Not what happened after in general. You can't tell the history of the world, but what happened after on the points raised in the document. How typical is the document? Now, I'm doing this for you could do it for this one, but I can't. This is typical in the sense that all of Captain Cook's diary is written like this for the first expedition. The diary for the second and third expeditions are much easier to read and much more exciting because he realises he can sell the books. And other explorers' diaries are extremely different. I mentioned Bougainville, who's a literary guy. He's a great writer. He's an adventurer. This is very... then we arrived and we shot somebody and then... which boat was it? I can't remember. It's very cold in a way. The other thing about this is that when it was published, the person who published it in the 20th century had the original manuscripts. And he said this passage was rewritten several times. So what we have to imagine is that James Cook, he's aware that, you know, arriving and killing people on the first day, it's not great. Now, this is the 18th century, so there's no question of anybody being accused of murder. But nevertheless, you know, the image of Britain, you know, we go around the world, meet new and interesting people and kill them. It's not a good image. And so he tries to write it in a way which in some ways will minimise. And we'll see this in a moment. There's some very, very interesting bits there. So those are all the things. So let's see. Let's go back to the beginning and look at it. Gentle breezes and clear weather. PM stood into the bay and anchored on the northeast side. PM, though, in the afternoon. Yeah, in the afternoon. Now, the reason this is interesting, and which you couldn't know, is in ship's journals, bizarrely enough, the day begins at noon, at midday, and finishes at noon. Why? Well, first of all, especially in ships at the time, yeah, there's no GPS, yeah, there's no radar. Somebody has to be awake all night in case you hit something. and so it's a 24-hour deal. And the tradition is to begin at midday and finish at midday. And that's why he talks first of all about the afternoon and then about the morning. Now, what's interesting about this is that in the second expedition journal and the third expedition journal, he doesn't do this. He begins in the morning because his second and third journals, he's already thinking these are written for interested readers. But the first one is just written for his boss. Just written for the Admiralty, which is answering question two, to whom? So it's just written for the Admiralty. That's who he's talking to, his boss. And how do you know this? Well, first of all, there is a lot of technical information. It's a fine sandy bottom. That's the bottom of the water, underneath the water. Who cares? The reader doesn't care. But the next sailors who come here need to know that, knowing what the land is like. Remember, I was telling you that sailing is really dangerous in the 18th century. And so all of this information, 10 fathom water, how deep was it? These are things you need to know if you're going around. And that's all the detailed, yeah. The northeast point of the bay bore east by south, 1 on 2 S. I don't understand this, but it's technical information. Because his job, he's a scout. Yeah. When the next British sailors come here to trade or to colonise, we don't know yet. But, you know, for the Empire needs to know this. So the nature of the seaboard is important because they need to know if it's a good place to anchor. Distant from the shore, half a league. A league is a unit of measurement which has different meanings in different parts of the world. In the English-speaking world, a league was 3 miles on land or 3 nautical miles at sea. A nautical mile is longer than a land mile. Don't ask. I don't know. I don't know why. And of course, the pinnace and the yawl are two smaller vessels, two smaller ships to be used. After this, I went ashore with a party of men in the pinnace and yawl, accompanied by Mr. Banks and Dr. Solander. So the noticeable thing here is that the very first people to go to meet these unknown Maoris are the captain and Joseph Banks, the richest man on board, and Dr. Solander, the scientist botanist. So they're not scared. Now, okay, they have guns and they know that the other side do not have guns, so yeah, that does help. But they're not sending the little people to check them out first. We landed abreast of the ship on the east side of the river, but seeing some of the natives on the other side whom I was desirous of speaking with, and finding we could not cross the river, I ordered the yawl to carry us over and the pinnace and lay at the entrance. In the meantime, the Indians made off. In this case, so James Cook is following tradition and referring to the locals as Indians. This goes back to Columbus, who was hoping to arrive in the West Indies, in India, and found Jamaica. I said, oh, these must be Indians. And indeed, I don't know if you know this, but Columbus never knew that he had found America. He never knew that. He died thinking he'd got to India. This is why for a long time, Jamaica, the Caribbean, we called it the West Indies. It's India, but it's to the west, so he calls them Indians. So they're exploring, they go as far as the huts. However, we went as far as their huts. Now, this little detail, which you don't know, you notice that he spells huts with two T's. Perhaps you know, it doesn't have two T's, it only has one. And this, in fact, is a sign of Cook, who never went to school, really. He was not educated. He spelled a lot of things wrong. Now, this was more acceptable at the time than today. Today, we're very strict about spelling. Oh, it's so important. Shakespeare spelt his own name in three different ways. He didn't care. It wasn't so important at the time. But in the 18th century, spelling is just being standardized. I explained to you that the first dictionaries of English, Johnson's dictionary, were being published. So he tells the little story. Four men came out of the woods and would certainly have cut her off, blah, blah, blah. And the coxswain of the pinnace fired two muskets over their heads. Yes, so he is firing warning shots. They're not really warning shots, because if you have never seen a gun in your life, it's not a warning. It won't. It's a big loud noise. It's clear that there is a, let's say, a considerable amount of indifference to the locals, yeah? If he thought a little bit, he would know that they couldn't understand a warning shot. They'd never seen a gun in their lives. And of course, the guns, if your friend is killed by a gun and you have never seen a gun in your life, it appears to be magic. So what else can you do? It must be God or magic. And so I think the Maori were very brave to come back again the next day. And I think I already mentioned to this, I have read 50 history books about Cook, and I have never seen anybody say that the Maori were brave. And half of them say that Cook was brave. And this is what colonialism, even today, the last bits, this is what we're talking about, decolonizing history. This is the sort of things we're thinking about. It's important to me. So he gives them a warning shot. But the second they took no notice of one, upon which a third was fired and killed one of them upon the spot, just as he was going to dart his spear at the boats. Je sais que vous hésitez à répondre à des questions auxquelles vous avez tort, mais c'est pas grave. Est-ce qu'il y a quelqu'un un commentaire sur cette phrase? A third was fired and killed one of them upon the spot, just as he was going to dart his spear at the boats. Yeah.
pretty funny considering how they're not really in the risk of dying because they're on the boat.
Yeah, so it doesn't seem like they're in a great danger, does it? Certainly, it doesn't seem like Cook and his men are in great danger. Yeah, and anything else about this sentence? Let me remind you, it was rewritten several times. This part, he's making the killing seem justified. La victime fonce sur les policiers dans sa voiture quand on a ouvert le feu. Ça vous dit pas quelque chose? À chaque fois qu'il y a quelqu'un qui a une arme et les autres n'ont pas l'arme et on les tue, c'est toujours, ils étaient sur le point. Et donc, this is Cook in the 21st century. Il était sur le point de foncer sur nous. Il était sur le point de lancer son c'est, quel est le mot pour spear? J'ai oublié. Sa lance. Il était sur le point. Peut-être pas que oui, peut-être pas que non, mais but let's say that we are not obliged to believe him. Yeah, we are not obliged to believe him. And certainly, now, one might expect him to say, because remember, these are not criminals, these are just Maori who just live there. One might expect him, yeah?
Oh, I want to mention something very quickly. It's funny how here he was passive speech, which is the same thing that American cops do when they shoot someone. They don't say that a cop shot someone, they say that shots were fired.
Yes, that's very good. Yeah, very good. Shots were fired. Now, does he say this? Not quite, because he does say the coxswain fired two muskets. Oh, right, you're right. The second they took, a third was fired. Yeah, a third shot was fired. Yes, yeah, so, yes, that's very good. And perhaps that's what he's doing. Vous savez que si vous travaillez dans un restaurant, il y a une grosse connerie qui est faite. Et bon, ça endommage quelque chose. Et vous le racontez au patron qui n'était pas présent. Bon, voilà, vous allez essayer de le raconter sans nommer le collègue qui l'a fait, quoi. C'est vrai, bon, voilà, il y a eu un accident, et voilà, il y a ça, il y a eu un accident. Normalement, bon, on essaie d'être solidaire. Et donc on va faire, ah ben, Jean-Michel a fait une galerie, et voilà le résultat. Ça ne se fait pas quand le patron est là. And so we have a little bit of this here. Cook is writing to his boss. And so he says the coxswain fired two muskets, and then a third was fired. Yeah, I hadn't caught that. Well done. So he's very, and we know this because in other sections of his journal, which he wrote twice or three times or four times, often the objective is to avoid incriminating. Now, they weren't risking a lot. Nobody was going to try them for murder. The other thing that we might consider, well, I mean, of course, they made no attempt to shoot him in the leg or anything like that. Yeah, they just shot him and killed him, yeah? Now, the other thing we might consider is that it would have been conceivable for Cook to say, unfortunately, one of them was killed. Or even tragically, and he doesn't say this now. This is partly because he's being professional, but partly because he is confident that nobody cares. So certainly we have a sign of the colonial situation here. So from the point of view of a text commentary, en fait, les commentaires que je fais aujourd'hui sur ce texte suffiraient pour que vous écriviez 5 commentaires de texte là-dessus. J'en ai beaucoup plus. But what's important about this is just to try to take a little time to see the implications. This is difficult because you're in an exam, it's in English, and you're trying to do multitasking, you know. But just take a little time. And what is the implication? What is his attitude? What is Cook's attitude? Now, you have to take a little time, a few minutes in exam time, to think, so what is Cook's attitude? And then you try, well, he doesn't appear to be regretting. He seems to be excusing, in this first case, he seems to be excusing, just as he was about to dart his spear. Aucun des autres n'avait lancé une lance, hein? Pourquoi il était sur le point de lancer la lance? Okay. So let's continue. The other three stood motionless for a minute or two, patati patata, or as we say in English, blah blah blah. No, you can't say patati patata in English. A little bit further down, upon our hearing the reports of the muskets, we immediately repaired to the boats, and after viewing the dead body, we returned on board. Now this man is Tyrael. That's the name of the Maori who was killed. According to oral tradition in the Maori, we have some 19th century interviews, so interviews 30 years later or 40 years later, of people who were present, who say who it was and what happened to him. So there's a Maori tradition explaining. And what's interesting is that today, I mentioned this already when you saw about the museums, today they, in history books, they name the Maori. And this is enormous because, of course, if you die and you don't have a name, that's not really respect. Yeah. So they name the guy. Now, the published version of these are things you couldn't know. I'm giving you more information. When James Cook went off on his second expedition, Mr. Hawkesworth, who was a very popular writer, was asked to write Cook's diary in a version that would sell. You know, to write it up, and finally, when Cook saw it, he was furious because Hawkesworth took Cook's diary and Banks's diary and made some stuff up and wrote a diary which was half history and half. And in Hawkesworth, he describes the dead man in detail, the tattoos on his face, the unknown material of his clothes and his hairstyle. Because he's writing a good book, he said, so he wants to describe everything about the person and so on and so forth. Okay, well, so let's go ahead. We returned on board in the morning. Seeing a good number of the natives at the same place, I went ashore with the boats manned and armed and landed on the opposite side of the river. Mr. Banks, Dr. Solander and myself at first only landed. The natives being got together on the opposite side. We called to them in the George Island language. If you have memorized by heart my class from last week, you will remember that George Island is which island? That's the one. Yes, I can see you almost have it. Tahiti. Tahiti is King George's Island. So they called out. They had learnt a few words of the language from Tupaya, who has been on board for months. And indeed, on board ship, they write word lists, English and Tahitian. They make a kind of dictionary. They're not great linguists, but nobody was at the time. But they know, and so they know how to say in Tahitian. So they call out to him. And a little later, we'll find out that when Tupaya speaks to them in his language, they understand him. What? He's from Tahiti. They're from New Zealand. How come they understand him? Well, this is where we come to the huge difference between New Zealand and Australia. The New Zealanders arrived 300 years before, maybe 500, a few hundred years before, from the islands of Polynesia, including Tahiti. And this is why they're very, very lucky, because when they say a few words in Tahitian, they understand it's not the same language. But it's like if you imagine you're French and you're in Italy, you can do things. I mean, and all you want to do is stop people killing you. Then it's close enough. Yeah, per favore, pour une faveur. That kind of thing. And so this is the reason. And this was very helpful because Tobia could speak to them, and if he used simple words, they could understand him. And this was obviously very useful to them. However, when they arrive in Australia in a few weeks' time, Zero comprehension. Absolutely zero. Because the Aboriginals have been in Australia for 60,000 years. And so the language has no connection at all. So that's really interesting there. So that's what Tupoia did. In any case, we called to them in the George Island language, but they answered to us by flourishing their weapons over their head and dancing, as we suppose, the war dance. And I explained to you that the Haka is not exactly a war dance. And indeed, before a rugby match, it's obviously not a war dance, because it's not war. It's a game, it's a challenge. And so it's part of welcoming people. So they arrived and they wait for the marines to be landed, the soldiers. The use of force is taken for granted. Tupaya spoke to them in his own language and it was agreed, but surprised to find that they perfectly understood him. After some little conversation had passed, one of them swam over to him, and after 20 or 30 more, we made them everyone presents. Now this seems to be universal, that if you're meeting people and you can't speak to them much, then it's presents. And of course they had some very impressive presents. For example, the iron nails. Iron was very, very useful to them. And then we have another killing. One of them snatched Mr. Green's hanger, that is to say his sword, and would not give it up. And so they killed him. He would prefer to avoid killing the locals, but it's not a problem for him, for Cook. And indeed, you notice here some of the use of words. Sometimes the words are important to comment. This encouraged the rest to be more insolent. Now, insolence is not a word that you use about people who you consider your equals. We usually say, in fact, old-fashioned parents talk about children as insolent. If a professor in the university referred to an insolent student, you think, oh, this is a very old-fashioned professor. It's a word really we don't use so much these days, we use it for children. And so here we see in the vocabulary, very specifically, then the attitude of Cook, a sign of Cook's superior attitude. Now this is important because when you are saying, oh, let's look at Cook's attitude, then you can illustrate it, one, with facts. It didn't worry him that the natives were killed. That's a sign of feeling superior, because if they're your equals, you care. Non-facts, the things which are absent, there is no attempt to, they will never try to find out his name of the killed person. And thirdly, then vocabulary, like, for example, insolent. Finding that nothing was to be done with the people on this side, I embarked with an attempt to row around the head of the bay in touch of fresh water and, if possible, survive some of the natives. You see, what he's... Remember that the communication is very, very basic. So he meets Maori here who have never seen Europeans, and they have this encounter that we're seeing here. And then he gets on the ship and he goes 20 kilometres further on, and he meets more Maori who have never seen Europeans. Yeah, the first contact is frequent. He must, in all his journeys, there must be 100 first contacts, because of course the Maori have no way to easily send information 40 kilometres away. It takes a long time. Walking, because also I'm pretty, they don't have horses. Do they have animals they can ride on? I don't think they have animals that they ride on. No, I don't think they have animals they ride on. So, yeah, it's a long way. And also, the arrival of the ship is so unlikely that when they leave, again, you know, they might be going back to heaven, or they could be, you know, it's just too weird a situation. Okay, well, listen, that was just the comments and some of the information about who, to whom, when, etc. Now, I think I already explained, this is a text commentary which is really above your level, but I'm hoping that you're learning something about it. You're not expected to be able to do this. I'm now going to actually read my commentary on this text. It will take about 10 minutes. And this is too long also for your exam, probably. Cook's encounter, introduction. Cook's encounters with the inhabitants of the places he visited have always been one of the most controversial aspects of his legacy. And the commemorations organised this year in New Zealand for the 250th anniversary, of course now it's later, have been the occasion for much, sometimes tense debate. He set out on his first expedition, armed with the instructions of the Admiralty to take possession of territories with the consent of the natives. The document of hints given to him by the President of the Royal Society insisted he and his crew should bear in mind the sanctity of human life and the equal value given by God to Western and Indigenous people. Perhaps having in mind the past treatment of Native Americans or of the populations of India by British colonies, the President of the Society seemed to feel it was necessary to advise Cook not to endanger the lives of the people he came across. The incident described in this extract would appear to show that these worries were justified. So that's my introduction. Now, because this document talks about first contact and killing natives, that is my excuse to show that I know that the Royal Society told Cook about that, and that I know. So I've got a link. I'm not going off topic. I'm linking it in. The approach I propose to take for this commentary is to pose the question of the status of Cook's document as historical document, as historical discourse. Can we take it as face value, as an objective narrative, as what happened? And what were the limits of Cook's intentions and Cook's understanding, which made it impossible for him to tell the full story? I shall first... J'annonce la structure. Bon, évidemment, hein. Si vous faites le tiers de ça, c'est très bien. I shall first look at what Cook attempts to show and what Cook hides. Secondly, I will examine what Cook's writing shows, accidentally or unintentionally. And finally, I shall look at what he could not know or reveal about the encounter because of the general situation of extreme cultural distance and inequality. Firstly, then, what Cook was trying to express. Like all documents, Cook's journal has an intended audience. This extract is from the first voyage, written at the time of their first arrival in New Zealand, in the vicinity of Gisborne. The journals of the first voyage were, as a rule, written to be read by Cook's military superiors at the Admiralty. Cook could not know that they would be read by a much wider audience. In the second and third voyages, however, his journals will gradually become aimed at a wider reading public. So, Cook first provides useful professional and technical information for his military superiors and for future navigators who might visit the area. This is the significance of the early lines about the weather and the anchoring conditions. He mentions the depth of the sea and the fine sandy bottom, for example. The fact that he uses shipboard time, which counts the days from noon to noon, is another sign that this is considered an internal Navy document. In later years, when he knows that his readership is far wider, he will count the days from midnight to midnight, as civilians do. When he goes on to recount the encounter and the killings, we can again see he has his superiors in mind. A footnote to this section in the Penguin edition, indicates that this passage has been rewritten several times. One can imagine it is being presented in the least damaging manner possible, since beginning by killing some locals could hardly be counted as a success. At the same time, since other crew members might also be questioned by the Admiralty, he would not want to stray too far from the facts. We notice, for example, that he does not name the crew member who kills the first Maori, simply referring to him as the coxswain. This is an approach which inspires elsewhere in the journals other rewritings to make an account which does not harm his loyal crew members. Further, the narration tends to excuse the killing by the coxswain. The Maori is said to have been about to attack, and the coxswain is said to have given warning shots. Alors, en réalité, est-ce que le marin a d'abord tiré deux fois pour les effrayer et ensuite l'a tué? On n'en sait rien. Peut-être, peut-être, peut-être pas. Mais c'est tout à fait concevable que Cook l'a inventé pour que ce soit pas trop méchant, quoi. On ne saura jamais, d'ailleurs. Mais je veux pas dire qu'il est généralement malhonnête, mais il y a plein d'autres endroits où il réécrit, où il change. We cannot be certain as to the truth of every detail. Yeah, I think that's something important in any text commentary. You have the view of one person. They may have an objective. People are often not very honest. I'm sure you don't tell all the truth to you, the whole truth to your parents all the time. I don't. As captain, Cook takes responsibility for the events, admitting that it was he who ordered the shooting of the second Maori who had taken one of the gentlemen's sword. The Maori would hardly have been more dangerous with an unfamiliar sword than with a spear he was accustomed to, so one might conclude the killing must be seen as a response to the insolence of the Maori warriors. Insolence. There are other elements which show Cook's consciousness of his readership. In Hawksworth, not the official publication of the diaries, the examination of the body is recounted in much more detail. The tattoos, the Maori's clothes. Cook's text is limited to what is necessary to report back from a scouting expedition. I would now like to look at some elements in this passage which the student of history may learn from, but which are not part of what Cook intended to convey. The first and most obvious aspect is the attitude of Cook towards the Maori. He uses words normally used about social inferiors, such as insolent. He shows a lack of interest in Maori priorities, in an expression which might even appear heartless after the killings recounted. Quote, "Nothing was to be done with the people on this side." His order to kill a man who had taken a sword, despite the absence of immediate danger, shows that Cook took for granted his power of life or death over the locals. This attitude is not due to Cook's particular personality, but due to the nature of the colonial project. Finally, I would like to examine another aspect of the historical document. Things which Cook could not have known or understood. One example is the haka, referred to as a war dance. A wider familiarity with Maori custom allows us to affirm that this is not a very accurate description. The haka has, because, become famous as an expression of New Zealand culture in international sports competitions, in particular rugby, since the All Blacks perform a haka before their matches in a symbolic attempt to intimidate their opponents. Yes, it is, of course, symbolic. They're not really thinking that their opponents will be scared. Yet the haka has also been reinvented as a 20th and 21st cultural expression. A recent example was the use of the haka as a national symbol of solidarity with New Zealand Muslims after the massacre at a mosque in Christchurch a year or two again. Naturally, the 21st century Hakka may not have been had the same meanings as the one which Cook encountered. Now, the use of the Hakka today in New Zealand, after Christchurch or other, is also something extremely significant. Unfortunately, 50 years ago, probably most white New Zealanders said, well, Maori culture, it's not interesting, it's not valuable, we don't care. It's dying. And so the fact that using the Hakka and using the Maori language is becoming common among non-Maori people is a big change. It's a big change. And I don't know what will happen next. The official New Zealand government attitude is we are a bicultural country. Notice this is different from what they say in Britain. We are a multicultural country. That means that we are very interested in the contribution made by a couple of million Indians, Pakistanis, Jamaicans, and so on. But New Zealand said we are a bicultural country. We would like to have to give equal respect to Pākehā culture. Pākehā is European. And to Maori culture. Now, I'm not saying they say they want to do this. Now, whether one, they succeed in doing it, or whether two, it's possible to do, are important debates. I don't have the answer for that, but that's the official policy, which is absolutely fascinating. I'm guessing you don't know a lot about New Zealand, yeah? I mean, why would you? Yeah? Has anybody been to New Zealand here? Yeah, no, me neither. It's on my list. And I have more money than you, but I've never been there. I have been to Australia, but the university paid, so that was easier. Another example is the attitude of Cook to the taking of their possessions by locals. This will be a constant course of violent encounters in all three of Cook's expeditions. The different First Nations encountered by Cook did not all have the same attitudes to property, but it has been suggested that the Western ideas of private property and theft may have been quite alien to certain populations encountered. The conclusion to be drawn from these different proofs of cultural ignorance on the part of the British visitors may be that Cook's mission of exploring, mapping, naming, describing, and taking possession was not compatible with a respectful exchange with locals. Firstly, Cook was obliged to spend little time before moving on. It is no doubt for this reason that his ethnographic descriptions of social hierarchy, customs and ceremonies are limited. They are of significant value in the sense that they are often the first descriptions available to Europeans, but Cook's descriptions are always constrained by the tight rules of a military scouting expedition. Decades after Cook, Europeans will have access to immeasurably fuller explanations of First Nations societies, sometimes produced by missionaries who spent months and years with these people, often intending to Christianize them and translate at least the New Testament into local languages. Much later encounters, more than 200 years afterwards, with unencountered peoples, particularly in the Amazon forests, will often be carried out with extreme caution in order to avoid Western diseases or aggression, causing widespread deaths among the encountered peoples. In conclusion then, the passage examined here has three aspects. As a report to his superiors, it tells us about Cook's mission, priorities and attitudes. As a document written by a colonial scout, it illustrates 18th century attitudes to such encounters. Finally, it makes reference to a series of actions on the part of the locals, which are much easier to understand today, now that a certain amount of Maori input into the explanations is possible. The 250th anniversary commemorations, or perhaps they are celebrations, are reflecting the tensions between interpretations which I have suggested above. A circumnavigation of New Zealand following the same path as did Cook is planned by a replica of the Endeavour, accompanied by a series of other ships, including traditional Maori vessels. The objective, in the context of a fairly official, if recent, New Zealand desire to promote biculturalism, was to commemorate a shared history. Some Maori representatives were prepared to participate, whereas others felt it was more appropriate to protest against any celebration of Cook's arrival, both because of the killings and because it was the symbolic starting point of the domination of Maori culture and society by the new arrivals. In an interesting twist, the focus in New Zealand, though not in Australia, seems to have been put on the ship and not on the person of James Cook. This change allowed Maori representatives and sympathisers to consider, if they wished, that Tupaia was as central as Cook on this expedition. Now, I always hesitate to present you with my text commentaries because, of course, I've been a historian for 30 years. You're not expected to be able to do this, but I hope that some of the methods will help. Notice a couple of things. Quotations. In this one, I didn't use many quotations, but if I had, it's better to say line 14. And not to copy out whole sections of the... You're just using time. How many points do you get for copying things out correctly? None. This is a university, yeah? Quite often you're... ça fait un peu je meuble. Okay. So I would say, try to take some risks. It's better to have interpretation which actually isn't correct than I'm not doing any interpretation, I'm just paraphrasing. That's the first thing. Does anybody have any questions about this? Yeah, did this? I hope this didn't just seem absolutely impossible. So a little bit impossible. Okay. Notice that I know that students are often very worried about going off sujet. Now.